Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on journalistic fraud by Bob Cohn. The New York Times, how the New York Times distorts the news and why it can no longer be trusted. Well, last time we were talking about crusades, polls, placement, facts, bias, slander, and fraud, and opinion, which leads us to the loaded coverage, distorting with labels. Distorting with labels. How do we do that? Well, labels are the subject of a carefully documented book by Ann Coulter, who applies a more graphic term to the technique. Commonly, it's called slander. And Coulter makes the case that the liberal media acts like a classic propagandist, using name-calling to advance their political agenda. Progress cannot be made on serious issues, she says, because one side is making arguments and the other side is throwing eggs. In slander, she supports her case by citing a long list of editorials and op-ed pieces and television commentary that persistently demonize Republicans and conservatives by blatant name-calling. I'll just cite a few examples. The editors of the New York Times continually turn their back on their founder's aim of using language that is parliamentary in good society. Well, clueless on global warming, that's July 19th, 2001, an editorial in which the Times takes issue with Bush's opposition to the Kyoto Treaty without accounting for the president's reasons for his opposition. So the Times uses this headline. It says, clueless on global warming. The second headline says, half a commander-in-chief, November 5th, 2001. A Times editorial accusing President Bush of ignoring economic policy. And then Mr. Nader's electoral mischief, October 26th, 2000, in which the Times opined that Ralph Nader's presidential election campaign was a disservice to the electorate and dubbed Nader's actions as willful prankishness. Ken Starr's meddling, February 2nd, 1999, wherein the Times calls the special prosecutor a narcissistic legal crank who has an obsessive personality, excoriates him with charges of legal mischief, meddling, customary blundering, and says he's in need of a slap by the U.S. Senate. Now, in addition, the Times has allowed its op-ed pages to be graced with even finer language that is less than parliamentary in good society. Behind the smile of Bob Herbert, November 11th, 2002, in which the Times columnist calls the Republican Party slick, sly, slippery, wily, cunning, insidious, and dangerous. America's Most Wanting by Bill Keller, November the 2nd, 2002, in which the United States Congress is called a collection of the spineless, led by the cynical, constantly lap dancing for special interest cash. And then here's one, The Pitt Principle by Paul Krugman, November 1st, 2002, in which the Times columnist declared that Attorney General John Ashcroft, a former U.S. Senator and Attorney General for the state of Missouri, doesn't have much respect for the law or for the Constitution, particularly silly stuff about due process, separation of church and state, and things like that. Rummy Runs Rampant by Maureen Dowd, October the 20th, 2002, portraying the wartime Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld as being a drunkenly out-of-control empire builder. And then there's The Dead Parrot Society by Paul Krugman, October 25th, 2002, accusing the President of the United States of being slippery and evasive and running an administration that lies a lot. Well, that's the truth. It does lie a lot. And that's the truth. So you can see here that we use name calling. You see, if you can't meet somebody's argument, if you can't prove that this guy is wrong, then the only thing left for you to do is to call him names. Now, of course, I use four-letter words. So I don't mince around. I'm a longshoreman. So when I want to call somebody something, I just tell them, this is what I think of you. Now, of course, you can't do that in polite society. And so what we do is we use these kinds of invectives, these kinds of terms, you know, like sly and running, they call him slippery, evasive, and running an administration that lies a lot or is less than credible. You know, I could use slick, sly, slippery, wily, cunning, insidious, and dangerous. I have those kinds of labels hung on me by the Southern Poverty Law Center constantly. They quit sometimes back. I don't know if they woke up to the fact that I'm not what they thought I was, or if they just gave up because I'm incorrigible. I'm not quite sure what their motivation was, but I've done the same thing. I had a New York Times columnist come out, I don't know, it was about 10 or 15 years ago. Now, he came out here to the farm, and he wanted to interview me, and I said, well, sit down, Tom, and let's talk. And we did. And he went back to New York, and he published an article about me, and he called me everything I told him I wasn't. See, I said, I'm not a tax protester. I'm not here protesting any taxes. I'm not anti-government. And he said, I'm an anti-government tax protester. So I learned my lesson. George Bush doesn't like to give interviews to newspaper reporters, and neither do I. And that's because they lie a lot. See, at least the guy should have said, Gordon denies that he is a tax protester or anti-government. But all of his opponents claim that he is a tax protester and anti-government. You see, there's a big difference. If you're going to interview me, would you please report what I said? I know it's a wild new concept, all of you reporters out there. Would you just report what the guy said? And let your readers decide whether or not the guy is an anti-government tax protester or not, based upon what he says and what his opponents say. And then let somebody else make up their minds, instead of you trying to make up their minds for them. It's a wild new idea. Now, there's another factor that I think that we should take up, and it's bias, slander, and fraud. Now, the times have changed, and with it, regrettably, so has the New York Times. What was once considered the newspaper of record, now that's a moniker reportedly coined by an early advertising manager for the New York Times. It's quickly losing its reputation as a reliable source of news. The aim of this book is to convince the publisher of the Times to reverse the ideologically tainted news reporting practices that are destroying the integrity of his newspaper. The means is simple, by providing examples taken directly from within the four corners of the news pages. This book exposes the pronounced liberal bias that pervades the news pages of the New York Times. This book does not concern the political positions taken in the editorials or opinion columns of the Times, nor is it about media bias, insofar as that term has been used to describe perceptions of an overall liberal bias in the mainstream media. This book is about editorial opinion disguised as objective news and what can be done to stop it. The crux of this book is best illustrated by a joke that's been circulating around the Internet. It seems that the Pope was visiting Washington, D.C., and President Bush took him out for an afternoon on the Potomac, sailing on the presidential yacht. And as they were admiring the sights, all of a sudden the Pope's hat his white Zacato blew off his head and out onto the water. Well, the Secret Service guys started to launch a boat, but President Bush waved them off, saying, wait, I'll take care of this, don't worry. So Bush stepped off the yacht onto the surface of the water, and he walked out to the Holy Father's little hat, bent over, picked it up, and then walked back to the yacht. He climbed aboard. He handed the hat to the Pope amid stunned silence. The next morning, the New York Times carried a story with front page photos of the event, with a banner headline that read, "Bush Can't Swim." Well, the revelations of frequent acts of journalistic fraud upon the discovery of May 2003 that the Times staff reported, a guy by the name of Jason Blair, engaged in fabrications and plagiarism that may have polluted hundreds of the paper's news articles, brought to light what may be the underlying cause of the journalistic fraud addressed in the following pages. So as the Times scrambled to defend its reputation in the aftermath of its startling disclosure, facts about the circumstances leading up to the scandal began to surface. Commentators in the media, including respected journalists and academians, began to accuse the top managers of the Times in the newsrooms of arrogance, hypocrisy, and incompetence. Now, you'd expect that these unfortunate events would have humbled the publisher and resulted in an earnest, honest effort to uproot the offending practices. While the Blair scandal led to a high-level management shakeup, there are no signs of any real institutional changes on the horizon. On the day that the Times announced the resignation of Howell Raines as executive editor, the Wall Street Journal reported on the debacle with views from those inside and outside of the Times. There is an endemic cultural issue at the Times that is not a Howell creation, said veteran Times reporter Linda Greenhouse in her article, Amid Turmoil, Top Editor Resigns at the New York Times, June 6, 2003. It's a culture where speaking the truth to power has never been particularly welcomed. In an editorial entitled Turmoil at the Times, June 6, 2003, the editors of the Wall Street Journal honed in on the broader questions of credibility still facing the Times. They said, quote, "Our view is that what we have been seeing on the front page of the Times in recent years is less straightforward reporting and more advocacy journalism. In this sense, the scandal over Jason Blair's fabrication is symptomatic of a broader credibility problem that won't vanish merely because Mr. Raines does," unquote. And yet, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the publisher of the Times, has since made it clear that readers can expect no real change in the paper's strategic vision. When he was asked by the New York Observer, Sulzberger Jr. vows to write Times course, published on June 16, 2003, about the future of the front page after Raines' departure. Sulzberger bristled, "That strategy, Mr. Sulzberger said, things that are strategic don't change with people," unquote. So despite the managerial shuffle, the Times' practice of distorting its news pages to reflect its ideological opinions goes on, and the reputation of the New York Times as a credible source of news has gone into a tailspin. After all, that's strategy. Much has been published on the subject of liberal media bias. Bernard Goldberg, he's a veteran reporter for CBS News, courageously blew the whistle on his colleagues in his book called Bias, published by Regeneray, R-E-G-N-E-R-Y, in 2001. In that best-selling expose, Goldberg revealed in stunning detail how liberal bias pervades television newsrooms, not by virtue of a well-orchestrated, vast left-wing conspiracy, but by a common view of the world held by those who occupy America's newsrooms. He says it's endemic. It's right there in the newsroom. Hang on. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the average American household today making between $22,000 and $30,000 a year spends about 16% or $5,000 of its income on food. And if that household makes between $40,000 and $60,000 a year, they'll spend about 10% or about $6,000 on food. Well, 12% of American households now purchase organic produce, and they buy from health food stores, organic produce salesmen, and farmers markets. Now, that translates into some 34 million people coast to coast and border to border, and already there are more than 4,000 small organic farms producing organic fruits and vegetables and meats on 25 acres or less, and they're making at least $100,000 a year serving this growing specialty market. Some of these farms are as small as 3 acres, and they're in every state in the union. Old Henry Kaiser summed it up very nicely when he said of his business success, "Find a need and fill it." Well, you know, here's a need that's just waiting to be filled. And the law school has a program to teach you how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. This is a 5-day school and includes lessons on marketing, business plans, growing organic foods, and law. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package? Remember, it's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational, it's free of charge. So you're not going to lose anything by finding out, are you? And you can order yours right now by calling direct, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about journalistic fraud, how the New York Times distorts the news, and why it can no longer be trusted. It's written by Bob Cohn, published by WND Books. It's www.wndbooks.com. They're located in Nashville, Tennessee. Bob Cohn, Journalistic Fraud. I rated about a 1 in 20 book. It's not a 1 in 100. There are lots of books out there that talk about fraud and journalism. Give you the inside skinny on a number of aspects of journalism. But this book, published recently, I think is a real eye-opener and worth every penny of the $27.95 that we paid for it at Barnes & Noble. I recommend it highly to each and every one of you listeners listening to me right now. Journalistic Fraud, Why the New York Times is Losing Its Credibility, by Bob Cohn. Well, Ann Coulter, in her book Slander, published by Crown in 2002, enlarges upon what Goldberg called liberal hate speech, name-calling. You know, if you can't get into the argument and overcome your opponent with reason, logic, and common sense, then let's use hate speech and slander. Let's call them names. It demonstrates how the liberal media acts like a classic propagandist using name-calling to advance their political agenda. Progress cannot be made on any serious issue, she says, because one side is making arguments and the other side's throwing eggs. But again, this book is not concerned with name-calling or what the Times says on its editorial page, nor does it concern the media, which Eric Alterman, in his book, What Liberal Media, Basic Books, 2003, found to be on the whole more conservative than liberal, though arguably he purveys or is the purveyor of conservative commentaries such as Rush Limbaugh, have as much influence on public opinion as their liberal counterparts, such as the editorial pages of the New York Times. Alterman misses the point, though. Though conservatives may strongly disagree with editorials published by the Times or with liberal columns or other forms of liberal commentary, they do not fundamentally object to them for what they are, as long as such commentary is properly represented or labeled as such. What they, the conservatives, object to is commentary that is misrepresented as objective news reporting. They object to how news organizations use their news pages to convey the same opinions that appear on their editorial pages. Thus, the true debate is not about media bias, but about news bias. Alterman fools no one by trying to refute evidence of liberal bias by cleverly changing the playing field from a discussion of the news to a discussion of the media. Now, you can't take a lead front page story in the New York Times, place it alongside a Rush Limbaugh monologue, and then call them journalism for the purposes of weighing whether the media is biased. You see, the Rush Limbaugh program is pure commentary and analysis. It is never represented as being objective news. Rush Limbaugh is a partisan. Rush Limbaugh is opinionated. Rush Limbaugh is telling you his opinion, and he doesn't make any bones about it. He's not out there telling you this is objective and is therefore by nature biased. You see, under no circumstances could the same be said of lead stories appearing on the front page of the New York Times, and to suggest otherwise is to fundamentally misunderstand the difference between telling the truth and telling a lie. Well, this book makes no claim that the media as a whole has a liberal bias. It more modestly intends to demonstrate systematically that a liberal bias pervades the pages, the news pages of the New York Times. In other words, what this book takes aim at is not the slander, but the journalistic fraud, the lies that appear on the front page under the guise of news, when in reality they're not news, they're opinion, they're philosophy. What Goldberg called passing off editorial opinion as straight news, and what Colder, from the reverse perspective, called ostensibly objective news coated with smears, name-calling, you right-wing radical fanatics. Well, what's wrong with left-wing radical fanatics? It's this. Calling people names, right-wing radicals, or left-wing radicals, begs the issue. What's radical about the left wing? What's radical about the right wing? What's radical about this man's views? Shouldn't we report his views and then let you determine whether or not they're radical or not? Do you need to be told that this guy is a radical, left-leaning communist, or he's a right-leaning, right-wing nationalist? Can't you make that determination for yourself without being brainwashed or politically corrected? Psychopolitics? Well, it's not about the media, but the news, and purportedly hard news, objective news, straight news, and how that news is distorted for the purpose of influencing public opinion, aligning it with the liberal views of the Times. This book also explores how the integrity of the Times is being destroyed under the stewardship of its current publisher, and what can be done to save a great American institution from this kind of folly. Now, there's a tradition of impartiality, and it had to have been the long-standing tradition of the New York Times to strive for total impartiality in its news reporting. When Adolf Ox purchased the Times in 1896, the Times was widely considered to be an organ of the Democratic Party. To reassure Republicans of the paper's political objectivity, Ox published one of the only statements ever to have appeared in his paper over his name. It'll be the aim of the Times to give the news impartially without fear or favor, regardless of party, sect, or interests involved. Well, if that really came to pass, we would be lauding the Times, because that's what we thought the Times was. Adolf Ox's son-in-law, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who succeeded Ox as publisher, serving from 1935 to 1961, continued the Times' tradition of impartiality through at least the early 1950s. Sulzberger reconfirmed his father-in-law's premise and promise to report the news impartially without fear or favor. That promise, he once wrote, continues to be the role of the Times in the community. On the division between reporting the news and publishing editorial opinions, Sulzberger added, "We're anxious to see wrongs corrected, and we attempt to make our position very clear in such matters. And we make those positions clear on our editorial page." But we believe, he said, that no matter how we view the world, our responsibility lies in reporting accurately that which happens. Well, sometime before the end of Sulzberger's reign as publisher in 1961, the Times began to abandon its tradition of impartiality. In 1969, Herman H. Dinsmore, he's a 50-year veteran of the newspaper business as a reporter, editor, and college professor, published a book, All the News That Fits, a critical analysis of the news and editorial content of the New York Times. It was published by Arlington House in 1969. Dinsmore joined the foreign desk of the New York Times in 1929, rising to the position of editor of its international edition from 1951 through 1960, after 30 years as a reporter and a senior editor of the New York Times. Dinsmore retired to teach journalism at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. He, like Bernard Goldberg, knew firsthand what he was talking about. And reflecting on the transformation of the Times from a great newspaper prior to the end of World War II to what it had become by the end of the 1960s, Dinsmore unabashedly introduced his 1969 book with the following blunt disclosure. He said, quote, "The New York Times today is deliberately pitched to the so-called liberal point of view, both in its news and in its editorial columns," unquote. Now, his book proceeded to expose the worldview of his colleagues, the paper's editors of that time, and provided specific evidence of the bias employed by the Times during the 1950s and 60s, just as this book is doing in the 21st century. As just one example, the book makes a serious and convincing case that the New York Times, through a series of editorials and news articles, was influential in bringing Fidel Castro and his communist regime to power in Cuba. It was a Times reporter in Havana who reported that Fidel Castro's Cuba was free, honest, and democratic, as thousands suffered and died in Castro's political prisons. Similarly, in the 1930s, Walter Durante, a Times correspondent in the Soviet Union, assured readers that there was no actual starvation in the Ukraine while Stalin was mounting his campaign to collectivize the farms in the region. The West later discovered that Stalin's actions resulted in a famine that claimed the lives of 16 million people. For his deceptions, Durante won a Pulitzer Prize, an award that has been challenged and is now under review by the Pulitzer Board. In terms of their human dimensions, these distortions of the truth tower over the startling but relatively minor accounts of lies and plagiarism by Times reporter Jason Blair. And yet the Times calls this most recent affair a low point in the 152-year history of the newspaper. Well, no doubt Blair's actions represented a profound betrayal of trust, as the paper's mea culpa stated, but the journalistic fraud regularly engaged in by the Times goes far beyond the unethical conduct of a solitary reporter whose transgressions are merely symptomatic of a more endemic problem. While the Times engaged in damage control in response to the Blair scandal, it failed to address the journalistic fraud that had long been spreading through its news pages like a virus. The New York Times may have emerged from the intensive care necessitated by the lapses of this one reporter, but its ultimate credibility will depend on whether its publisher recognizes the full extent of the problem and, by addressing its causes, and then implements a cure. Now, there's been a change in the Times. On May 22, 2001, Arthur Ochs Sulzberger, Jr., the grandson of A.H. Sulzberger and current publisher of the New York Times, announced the appointment of Howell Raines as the new executive editor of the paper, effective September 6, 2001. And for nearly 9 years prior to that appointment, Raines had been the Times editorial page editor, what may be considered the chief opinion officer of the New York Times. Now, as executive editor, Raines assumed the role of chief news officer responsible for reporting the news, with the news division staff of about 1,200 people worldwide at his disposal. And upon the announcement of Raines' appointment to head the news division, Sulzberger wrote an internal memo to the Times staff. Well, let's take a break here, and we'll be back, and we'll take a look at Hal Raines and his tenure at the Times. You're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, biotech beans, chemical corn, frankenfish, and the pesticide potato, that's what's on the menu at your local neighborhood supermarket. And we are concerned that this technology is a serious threat to our health, to traditionally bred open-pollinated seeds, and to the environment and the farmers that grow them. Listen to this quotation. It comes from the Chicago Tribune when they said, quote, "We are being exposed to one of the largest uncontrolled experiments in history. In less than 5 years, these companies have flooded the marketplace with thousands of untested and unlabeled products containing foreign genetic material, and these genetically modified organisms pose several real dangers because they've been engineered to create novel proteins that retard spoilage, produce their own pesticides against insects, or allow the plants to tolerate larger and larger doses of weed killers." Unquote. And you know, what's really scary about all this is that it isn't from Tom Clancy's latest thriller. These seeds are already a major part of the U.S. corn and soybean crop. Now, what's going to happen if one of these so-called suicide genes, which prevent seed saving, what if it goes haywire and destroys the entire U.S. corn crop? Or what if it turns out that genetically modified rice kills people? Or what if it causes genetic mutations or birth defects in people like thalidomide did back in the 1950s? What if? You know, I don't want to take that risk. I don't want to be a guinea pig in this ill-advised experiment, and I'll bet you don't either. That's why the law school has a program to teach you how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. Now, this is a 5-day school that includes lessons on marketing, business plans, growing organic foods, and law. Why don't you call and order my free 4-hour CD package? It's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours. The number's 417-273-4967 to order yours. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the changing times. Now, when Hal Raines took over the appointment to head the news division, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. wrote in an internal memo to the Times staff, he said, what to say about Howell? Well, most of you know him as our esteemed, fire-breathing, take-no-prisoners editorial page editor. Howell Raines is what the Times would call an unabashed liberal. A profile of Raines in the New Yorker entitled The Howell Doctrine, June 10, 2002, stated, quote, "Arthur Sulzberger Jr. knew that Raines, like him, took liberal positions on affirmative action, capital punishment, abortion rights, health insurance, welfare, the environment, and the role of an activist government." Sulzberger said that he saw the editorial page editor and the executive editor as partners in the Times' future. And in an autobiographical book published in 1993, Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis, William Morrow and Company, Raines wrote about his disgust for President Ronald Reagan. He said, quote, "In 1981, shortly before the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, my family and I arrived in Washington. I had arrived in our nation's capital during a historic ascendancy of greed and hard-heartedness. Then one day in the summer of 1981, I found myself at the L.L. Bean store in Freeport, Maine. I was a correspondent in the White House in those days. And my work, which consisted of reporting on President Reagan's success in making life harder for citizens who were not born rich, white, and healthy, saddened me. Reagan couldn't tie his shoelaces if his life depended on it. Unquote. Hal Raines, editor of the New York Times. This is a part of that name-calling that we saw earlier. And even after he assumed his post as head of the news division, Raines continued to wear his extreme left-wing political views on his collar. On November 30, 2001, Raines appeared on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, hosted by Brian Lamb, regarding President Clinton and his policies, particularly the ill-fated attempt to introduce socialized medicine in the United States. And Raines said, quote, "We had editorially supported virtually every aspect of his program and were particularly evangelical, I would say, about his medical care reform package." On August 6, 2002, Raines appeared on the Charlie Rose Show, broadcast on PBS. When asked how history would judge Bill Clinton, Raines steered clear of the fact that Clinton was only the second president in U.S. history to be impeached. And he replied, quote, "Huge political talent, huge political vision, and I suspect none of us. I can't predict who's going to win the next election, how much less what history is going to say about anyone. But I think President Clinton's role in modernizing the Democratic Party around a set of economic ideas and also holding on to the principles of social justice and presiding over the greatest prosperity in human history, those would seem to me to have to be the central, or to be central to his legacy." Well, shortly before Raines assumed control of the newsroom, a few solitary words of concern were being expressed about the propriety of Raines' selection as chief editor of the Times News Division in a piece published in the Washington Post. It was called "A Liberal Bias" on August 29, 2001. And columnist Robert J. Samuelson wrote this. He said, quote, "We in the press are routinely self-righteous, holding others, politicians, public officials, and corporate executives to exacting standards of truthfulness, performance, and conflict of interest. But we, the journalists, often refuse to impose comparable standards on ourselves, leading some or much of the public to see us as hypocritical. A troubling example involves the recent promotion of Howell Raines from editorial page editor of the New York Times to executive editor. In many ways, he seems superbly qualified. Raines, 58, has been a Times bureau chief in both London and Washington. In 1992, he won a Pulitzer Prize, but what ought to disqualify him in his job as editorial page editor, where he proclaimed the Times' liberal views, every editor and reporter holds private views. The difference is that Raines' opinions are now highly public, and his page took stands on dozens of local, national, and international issues. It was pro-choice, pro-gun, pro-gun control, rather, and pro-campaign finance reform. Last year, it endorsed Al Gore. In general, it has been critical of President Bush, especially his tax cut. Now, does anyone believe that in his new job, Raines will instantly purge himself of these and other liberal views? And because they're so public, Raines' positions compromise the Times' ability to act and appear fair-minded. And many critics already believe that the news columns of the Times are animated and distorted and by the same values as its editorials. Making the chief of the editorial page the chief of news columns will not quiet those suspicions. But when asked about possible conflicts, publisher Arthur Ox Sulzberger Jr., who selected Raines, dismissed them with a short statement. He said, quote, "The brilliant and honorable tenure of Max Frankel as executive editor of the Times from 1986 to 94, following his years as editorial page editor from 1977 to 86, stands as a testament that a great journalist knows the difference between these two roles. And Howell Raines is certainly a great journalist. In other words, get lost. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, back during the 1970s, an obscure black college professor at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, while working on a grant, developed a unique marketing plan for agricultural products. The plan was aimed at poor rural black landowners in the South who owned small acreages. Well, the goal was to keep these landowners on their land by producing produce for sale to the public at retail and to generate an income that would support a family. It was called the Whatley Program, and it was so successful that it became known as the Whatley Program, how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. And that man was Professor Booker T. Whatley. Well, now there are more than 4,000 of these small family enterprises operating in the United States, and the law school has taken the Whatley program and added the 15 agricultural laws of the Bible and the 17 financial laws from Scripture so that you can practice all of the laws of the United States, all of the laws of your state, and all the laws of Scripture relating to agriculture and agricultural law to make a good living for you and your family and do it all at the same time. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. And the $100,000 class is also available on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. We're taking a look here at the agenda. You know, the agenda is everything. In the midst of its campaign to oppose military action against Iraq, the Times began to wage another crusade on its front pages. This time, the New York Times had set its sights on a 300-member golf club. Beginning in July of 2002, the Times published over 40 articles and editorials over a four-month period criticizing the Augusta National Golf Club. It's the host of the Masters Golf Tournament for not admitting women as members. Now, in an editorial entitled America's All-Male Golfing Society on November 18, 2002, the Times called upon Tiger Woods to boycott the Masters Tournament. When Tiger refused to submit, the Times turned its turrets towards CBS, who had the broadcast rights to the Masters Tournament. But instead of writing an editorial calling for CBS to boycott the Masters, the Times reserved room on its front page to report to the world that what CBS had not done. CBS staying silent in debate on women joining Augusta, November 25, 2002, and the next day a coy Times editorial staff responded to this news. They called it news with an editorial entitled The Masters Business, November 26, 2002, which called on CBS to boycott the 2003 Masters Tournament. Well, the Times' behavior on this occasion was loudly criticized. What was striking and different about this criticism, however, was that much of it originated not from conservative critics, but from within the Times' own staff of reporters. You see, an article published in Newsweek magazine was entitled The Changing Times by Seth Moonkin, December 9, 2002, who broke the news about the turmoil within the ranks of the New York Times. Newsweek magazine published the following remarkable statement by an unnamed Times staffer in reference to the November 25th article on CBS. It said, quote, "That was shocking. It makes it hard for us to live or to have credibility on other issues. We don't run articles that just say so-and-so is staying silent. We run articles when something important actually happens. And we take sides." Now, the Newsweek article revealed a growing recognition, especially among news reporters, that the Times was losing its reputation by disguising its editorial positions in the form of front-page news stories. Another Times staffer suggested to Newsweek that the chorus of complaints among the Times staff was growing so loud that Raines was in danger of losing the building. For example, many Times reporters were apparently ready to quit over the issue. Then, a few days later, all hell broke loose when the news surfaced that the Times refused to print two pieces written by its sports columnists, a column by Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Dave Anderson and a column by Times sports writer Harvey Ayrton, because they disagreed with the views expressed in the Times editorial pages on the Augusta National matter. The online edition of Newsweek, December 4, 2002, reported the story as follows, quote, "Newspapers are supposed to foster healthy debate, raise conflicting points of view, and present all sides of a story, aren't they? Isn't that what a newspaper is for?" Well, you're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and they helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and their country. Today, over half the food that we eat is imported from outside of our borders, and our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce. And that seed is nutritionally deficient. Now, Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds. When these were compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrom's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, 205% more manganese, and the same result was seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. So in the opinion of many eco-farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now to order yours. The number, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Would you do that? That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. We're reviewing the book called Journalistic Fraud by Bob Cohn, The New York Times Distorts the News and Why It Can No Longer Be Trusted, published by WNDBooks.com. Again, that's WNDBooks.com. Journalistic Fraud, How the New York Times Distorts the News and Why It Can No Longer Be Trusted, 2795 Barnes & Noble. A 1 in 20 read. I recommend it highly. I think it's dynamite. What we have suspected of the news media, and especially the liberal left-wing mainstream media, we call it. If it's true with the Times, it's true with the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. These newspapers use the same tactics and techniques. It was first published by a fellow back in 1958. And it's true today just as it was back in the 1950s. These concepts of deception, these practices, these systematic manipulation of your mind and mine by these techniques, these tricks that are used, isn't something new. It's been going on for generations, hundreds of years. Deception and lies have been more modernized. They're slicker today. They're more refined today than they've ever been in the past. But it doesn't mean that they didn't exist. William Randolph Hearst was called a yellow journalist. And he was. And we deplored his system of yellow journalism, of calling people names, of lying in the press, of deliberate deception. But Hearst had a goal. Hearst had a motive. Hearst wanted to make money. Hearst lied to sell papers. The New York Times lies, not just to sell papers, but to promote a political new world order. That new world order may be good for us. Maybe we should adopt it. But don't you think that we should have objective reporting so that people can make up their own minds? I know this is a wild new concept. Just report the facts and then let people decide for themselves what it is they want to do. And if these people want to make a mistake, you know, God did that back in Old Testament times. You'll read about this in 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's an interesting story. It's a story where the people came to Samuel. Samuel was the chief judge in the land. He held the office of our chief justice of the Supreme Court, chief judge. And they came to him and said, "We want a king like all the nations around us." And Samuel went to God and he complained. And he said, "Listen, these people are nuts." God agreed with Samuel, and he said, "Yeah, these people are nuts, but hey, listen. Listen, why should we get in the way of the people's happiness and success? They're about to make a bad mistake. So go to them and tell them that this is a bad mistake. Go to them and tell them what manner of king they're going to get. Tell them how he's going to tax them to death. Tell them how their tax rates are going to go up from modest 7% to 91%. Tell them about the military-industrial complex. Tell them about the Internal Revenue Service and ex post facto laws and bills of attainder. Explain to them how this king is going to oppress them and take their property away without just compensation." And Samuel did. He went to him and he said, "Look, boys, let's be intelligent people here. We have the God of the universe. We have the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not just an ordinary God like the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Assyrians. A God that you make with your own hands. We've got the real deal. We've got the real McCoy." Well, the people, they didn't spend too much time thinking about it because they came back and they said, "Nevertheless, we'll have a king like all the nations around us." Now, you'd think that a God that's powerful enough to destroy the whole Egyptian army in 20 minutes in the Red Sea would have got onto these people and straightened them out in no uncertain terms by striking them all dead, but he didn't. He didn't. You'll find that the God of the Bible is the God of, the author of free choice. If you want liberty, the Bible is called the perfect law of liberty. So what he did was he said, "Give them what they want." It's the majority view. My God, it's democratic. The people have rejected me. They do not want me to serve as their king. They've rejected me from the time we came out of Egypt. Go ahead, give them a king. Give them a king, and then you tell them what this king is going to do to him, and then when he does it to you, you're going to cry out to me in that day," referring to the end times, referring to George Bush, Hillary Clinton, or somebody of that caliber. And he said, you'll cry out to me, and in that day I will not hear you. Well, welcome to reality, boys and girls. When we said we wanted to overthrow King George and establish a republic, when we went into a violent civil war and said we want to change our republic to a democracy, when we came to the Federal Reserve decision in 1913 and said we want to abandon just weights and balances, we want unjust weights and balances, we want commercial paper, stocks and bonds, we want real money, something that we can make profit and gain and charge interest and usury on. You didn't find the God of Abraham butting into your business. You didn't see God coming around here giving you some right-wing editorial. God has a very unusual and maybe even bizarre methodology of handling the recalcitrant attitudes of people. Let these people do what it is that they have in mind to do, and they will be reformed by their own actions. You want to try communism? Get with it. Get right in with it up to your elbows. You want to try socialism and commercial paper? Hey, get right after it. Don't let me get in your way. Bring them on, as George Bush would say. Now, as a result of that, we Americans have some problems here. The New York Times is just a symptom. It's symptomatic of an overall problem that we see in what we call the liberal media. They lie to us a lot and they mislead us. We make bad decisions because we get bad information. It's garbage in, garbage out. When the New York Times representative, the newspaper columnist from Russia, reports that Uncle Joe Stalin is treating these people in the Ukraine humanely, and he's really a nice guy, 16 million people starved to death. We didn't even know there was a problem till after World War II. That was a bald-faced lie. I'm not sure that anything would have been done to stop it, but don't you think it would have been real nice if the people at the New York Times had reported the truth? What if we, you and I, were to get the truth? We got the real facts that came from not only the New York Times, but every newspaper, every news commentator, just unbiased, straight, right from the shoulder news articles that told us the truth. It's a wild new concept. We'll take up this story again next time, tomorrow night when we come back on the editorial review and the Law Hour. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and the editorial review. It's sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Here's tonight's wise old saying. High levels of testosterone, which causes overly aggressive and antisocial behavior, is commonly found in juvenile delinquents, substance abusers, rapists, dropouts, and trial lawyers. Remember that the Law Hour is brought to you by the law school. It's the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page. It's on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule of archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there goes the signal. It says our time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.